From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2014 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. I'm really glad you guys can be here with us this afternoon. We're going to take a look at a topic that we have not done before, and it's really a broad topic if you really want to think about it. Each and every one of us that are involved in our jobs or our professions probably has some aspect of this going on, but we're going to focus in on the medical aspect of it today from our guests from UAMS. Our topic today is research. In Little Rock, we are very blessed to have UAMS, and it is a center of research. My guests all are in the studio with me. From the older generation, speaking from that perspective anyway, is Dr. Larry Cornett. Dr. Cornett is a professor in the Department of Physiology and Biophysics and the Vice Chancellor for Research for UAMS. His research interests include the role of beta-2 adrenergic receptors in mediating airway responsiveness in asthma and hormonal regulation of stress responses. In addition, Dr. Cornett is the director of the Arkansas ENBRI and NIH-funded program to develop biomedical research infrastructure in the state. Dr. Cornett, glad to have you with us here today.
Thank you.
Speaking from the middle generation is... I had you in the middle. I wasn't sure where to put you. Speaking from the middle generation is Dr. Jose Romero. Dr. Romero participates in clinical research related to viral and antiviral therapies through the NIH and NAID. Dr. Romero's research interests focus on the molecular and pathogenesis and molecular epidemiology of intraviral infections. Additional areas of clinical interest include pediatric tuberculosis, viral central nervous system infections, and novel molecular approaches to the diagnosis of infectious diseases. Dr. Romero is the principal investigator on multiple pharmaceutical company-sponsored vaccine trials. Dr. Romero, glad to have you here, too.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And then speaking more or less from that younger generation is Dr. Mark Smeltzer, also from UAMS. His research interests include molecular pathogenesis of Staphylococcus. Staphylococcus aureus is a commensal inhabitant of up to 50% of the healthy adult population, but it also has the capacity to cause serious and even life-threatening infections. Dr. Smeltzer, glad to have you here too.
Thank you so much.
And on the side, actually, she's just here to kind of observe. The lady who was instrumental in getting all of our guests here from us from UAMS is Katrina Dupins. Glad to have you here too, Katrina.
Yes, thank you.
Getting into the discussion on research, I do want to mention this. If you went to high school or college in probably the year 1990 or before, you probably did research other than on a computer, or maybe it would be 1980, I guess, somewhere in there. But I know that when I graduated from high school in 1967, from college in 1971, and any and all research I did took hours, and it was entirely different. You guys are in research in the medical aspects at UAMS. I do want to begin with you, Dr. Cornett, and kind of take us back to the pre-computer days of how research was done even at UAMS or in other areas like that.
You are talking to somebody who knows how to use a slide rule, actually. And that's what I had to learn what to use when I was a student in college and had to do calculations for chemistry. So along the way, of course, calculators came along, which were a huge step forward for us. I view computers as being a great tool that supports research. I don't think really we're not doing research in a different sort of way than we did when I started 30 or so years ago, but the computer gives us a tool that allows us to analyze data in a much more rapid manner, to do statistical analysis in a much more rapid manner, and just overall allows us to move research forward more quickly. For the type of research I did, which was biological, we had many of the same instruments that we have today. I think the technology has changed. Instead of transistors, we have specialized circuits. But overall, we used the same tools in the laboratory. We just, you know, we went to the library, read books like we do now. But the computers made the difference because it gave us a way to record data more quickly and analyze it more quickly.
Were you forced to focus in on your research efforts rather than broaden them because you didn't have the tools you have now? Did you really have to just kind of say, well, I'd like to study this, but I don't have any way of doing it?
There are always limitations when you're thinking about doing research. I think even today we think, gee, we'd really like to do this, but We don't quite have the tools. So back then, it was sort of the same situation. We thought up research questions to ask, and we knew what tools we had available to answer those questions, and we used them.
Dr. Romero?
Don't you think that there's a little bit, I think not a little, quite a bit more collaborative research than there was in the past? I mean, it wasn't so much the lone investigator in the laboratory pounding out this question. You now have to really encompass two or three labs in order to answer some of the very basic questions.
I think that's a great point. I think 20, 30 years ago, individual investigators were more the norm. Nowadays, we're asking more complex questions that require more expertise to answer, and so we seek out collaborators and we form teams of scientists to try to answer those difficult questions.
The question that comes to my mind is that word peer review. Is peer review different now than it was then because of the access to the groups you have available?
Peer review has been a feature of science as long as I can remember, and I think it even goes back before any of us were
slide
about
rules.
Science, right? Even before slide rules, yeah. It's a fundamental feature of science and research in this country that's remained very strong, and I think makes our science very strong.
Yeah. If anything, peer review has become faster. Now with electronic transmissions, the limits placed on the reviewers is much tighter.
Dr. Smeltzer?
Obviously, I agree with everything that's been said, but much of it is in the context of convenience and speed. And I would just add that there are some technologies now that are available solely because we have computers. The bottom line is we can generate more data than we know what to do with. And the only way to sort through that in any sort of meaningful way, in any sort of reasonable time frame, is with a computer.
Well, let me stay with you, Dr. Smeltzer, and ask, I guess, the opposite question to the idea of technology available. Young people coming into the field, are they at all equipped to research in a way that Dr. Cornett's time would have been? Or are they solely dependent on all this technology, or could they reinvent the wheel if they had to?
I think that they probably are unfortunately solely dependent on this technology. You know, one really good example of both of those points would be DNA sequencing. You know, we can generate in an afternoon with technology today, millions and millions, tens of millions of base pair reads in DNA. And there's just no way that any human, even collaboratively, could sort through that. So that's one issue. To speak to your second point, the trouble is that there's enough urgency in doing research that, you know, most of my students, what they know about DNA sequencing is who runs the DNA sequencer. They don't really understand the technology. And that can be problematic because that leaves them in a position where they don't know how to do quality control. So do think that that's an issue that needs to be addressed as technology advances.
You mentioned the word urgency. Before we get too far into the program, I know those of you listening, all of us over the last few weeks have really been focused more on the situation with Ebola. And as we talk about research, Dr. Romero, that seems to be an area that you are involved with in a way. Can you talk to our audience about research as it pertains to what you know about this time frame of Ebola?
What we know about Ebola in the laboratory has really been done over the last 10, 20 years. And it's been done in very specialized laboratories, and it's used the technology that was mentioned beforehand. So sequencing, polymerase chain reaction, for example, is a technique that came out when I first started researching and was actually hands-on. You know, you have to optimize the conditions. Now you can buy a kit and do it in a matter of hours in your laboratory. Yes, they've done, much of what we know has been from working with this virus in the last 10, 20 years, and the molecular is definitely what we have learned in the last 5 to 10 years about the virus. What we're preparing for is the possibility that it could come to our state. We have to be able to rapidly identify who's at risk and then do the tests that are appropriate to rule that out. And those are really through the CDC and through the health department. And we don't have the capacity to do that test in our laboratories. And we wouldn't want to do them because it requires specialized laboratories with special containment areas in order to carry them out. So we are getting prepared in case we have a child. In my case, because I'm a pediatrician, in case we have a child with Ebola, we can screen them, we can take care of them at Children's Hospital, and then reaching out to the CDC and the health department for help with experts.
Okay. I don't want to dwell our entire program on the idea of Ebola, but I knew that was something that does touch with sort of with what we're talking about here today. Going back also to another part of research, I guess the second part about it that you think about all the time is the costs of research. Again, back to you, Dr. Cornett, funding and costs of research. How in the world did you do research from a cost standpoint years ago compared to whatever you have to do in your current time?
When I started out, we still relied heavily on the federal government to support research. And of course, in the area of biomedical research, it's the National Institutes of Health that provides funding. Today, that funding source is still there. It's still very important. Federal agencies are especially important in funding what we call basic research, which is discovery-based research. As research findings move on and they become translated into applications, sometimes industry, the private sector, pharmaceutical companies, device companies will pick up and carry on the research if they're sure that there will be a marketable drug or device at the end of that research.
Do you really need funding before you can actually do the research, or does the research get going on its own and all of a sudden you need money?
You always need money to do the research. Now, the source of the money for the research, very early stage, quite often, it's the university, in this case, the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, that might support the very, very early stages of the research in order for the investigator to collect the data that he or she needs in order to make an application to the federal government, National Institutes of Health, to receive a grant, which then would support the research at a higher level for a longer period of time.
And then maybe another group would pick up from there and continue?
Exactly. Uh-huh.
You know, what really has changed, I think, in the last 30 years has been the period of time necessary for the investigator to be trained in order to compete for those NIH grants, the R01s. When I started, many of us could get funding from the NIH within 5 years of having completed a period of training. Now, the first R01 doesn't occur until the investigator is in 40s, early 40s?
I know some of those numbers. So maybe 20 years ago, the average age for somebody getting their first grant from the National Institutes of Health was about 35 or 36. You figure they got out of training when they were about 30 or so. Now the average age for somebody getting their first grant from the National Institutes of Health is about 42 years old.
Well, let's jump over to Dr. Smeltzer. How do young people feel about that if they're researching, or those coming into the field? Are they struggling for funding?
The people that I am really concerned about are the people that I'm training, or that we're all training. I think they see, particularly now at a time when federal funding levels are depressed, they see us struggle to be competitive on a national scale. And I think that if we aren't very careful in the way that we mentor them, not just scientifically, but with respect to participation in the system and success in the system, I think that we run a real risk of them being discouraged and getting out of the business.
The politics of getting funding, has that changed? Is politics in the way of research? As a layman looking at the field you guys are in, I'm looking at it from a social political viewpoint. Is the world we live in different socially, politically, as it affects your abilities to have research funding? It seems to me, again, just as someone on the outside, and what I hear is that people aren't as interested in funding research anymore from a social, political perspective.
I don't think you're right about that, actually.
Good.
I think there's abundant data out there. There's an organization called Research America that from time to time does surveys of the American public and asks them questions about do you support biomedical research, questions like that. And overwhelmingly, the answer always comes back that they do. They're, you know, public's very concerned about their health. And I think most of them see that research in disease mechanisms is very important.
I think the general public might feels that way. However, you know, when we look at the way the funding has gone for the NIH, for the CDC, it's been cut. That cut impacts on our ability to really get to basic science questions. There's not enough funding around to support investigators in certain areas. You know, it's also important to know that, especially if you're doing basic science, which we all have done or are doing, you know, a lot of times answers totally different than the ones you are seeking come about. In other words, we know a lot about cellular biology because we studied polio, which is the group of viruses that I study. We know a lot about how cells make proteins and things that turn on and off those proteins because we studied a particular virus. That's a totally different offshoot than what was started out. How does a virus replicate? Well, now we've learned a whole bunch of different things. And the same thing with HIV and others. We learn a lot of indirect things by studying a certain virus mm-hmm. or a certain topic, a certain mm-hmm. aspect of physiology.
UAMS is a very critical part of medical science, and it has a really great reputation nationally. Give me an idea of some of the things that UAMS is really doing research in.
We really have broad-based research programs at UAMS, and also don't forget that our Department of Pediatrics is based at Arkansas Children's Hospital, and they have a very robust research program as well. When I'm asked what are our largest areas of research emphasis, I always think about the multiple myeloma program in the Cancer yeah. Institute. It is probably our premier program. It does research across the spectrum from basic to translational, has a huge impact around the country. Internationally, we have patients that come to the Myeloma Institute from all over the world. Other areas where we have considerable strength are in food allergies. There's a very strong group at Arkansas Children's Research Institute that very strong in peanut allergies and walnut allergies. Bone diseases is another area that's very strong. Dr. Smeltzer is involved in that kind of research. And then finally, another one is in the area of addiction research, substance abuse, very strong programs.
I'm working very hard to put Dr. Cornett in a position where he has to add infectious disease to that list.
You know, from a pediatric point of view, clinical trials, we're one of a handful of research centers that addresses questions regarding low incidence infectious diseases like herpes or CM or cytomegalovirus. Arkansas Children's UAMS contributed to developing the appropriate treatment protocols, which are used all around the world now. And we're asking questions of what's the best way to treat them, treat diseases like CMB or how to diagnose it. We're one of these groups of investigators that participate. Mm-hmm. So we're contributing at a national and international level at that.
And also to, toot the horn of UAMS, and this goes back probably 6, 7, maybe 8 years in our program. I did a program on cancer a number of years ago, and I had the 3 guests from the different generations. My younger guest was a young lady from Florida who had found out about multiple myeloma, the research here, and was told this was the place to go. And one of my other guests was from California, and her situation was much the same way. Her cancer was, they told her, go to UAMS in Arkansas. Both of them really had no knowledge at all that Arkansas or UAMS would be that far up the ladder of research capabilities. So I was very proud then, and I'm proud also to talk to you guys about research. Dr. Romero, you sort of mentioned just a few minutes ago about research that is going on and you find something on a side road. Flipping that question just a little bit, when you're doing research and you find things that you really wish you hadn't found, is it tough to counter your own research when you find things that are going on in that research that are a little bit different than what you really thought they were in a negative way?
One of the things we're taught as investigators is that you really shouldn't go into it with a preconceived notion of what it will be. In other words, you think what it might be, but if it turns out to be totally different, well, that's the way it is, and there are other avenues that open up from that. And I can tell you from personal experience, I've gone in thinking the thing I'm looking for is in this part of the virus. And when I look at it carefully, it's not there, but it's in another part. And along the way, we've discovered, well, this controls more than just what we're looking for. It controls other things. And so it opens up a whole new avenues. I think the mindset of the investigator is always open. If you're wed to a certain idea, then you're setting yourself up for failure.
You know, really, I think that's the fun part of research is that you don't always know what the result's going to be, and you get unexpected results, and it leads you off in a new direction. It's what makes it fun.
The way that I phrase it, at least to my students, is, good science is science that is done such that no is an answer. And oftentimes, the answer, it's fundamentally important to approach it that way. If you do the experiment so that no is an answer, the experiment is sound, then that question never has to be asked again. And people around the world, including yourself, can go into a new direction. maybe it was unexpected, but at least now you know that you need to go there.
Speaking of the unexpected, just yesterday on NPR, about this time in the afternoon, there was a story on about some stem cell research that was being done in the area of blindness. You may have heard it if you were listening anywhere yesterday. And the report was that these people were being given stem cells in their eyeballs for macular degeneration. And it was actually working really great. And it came about sort of in an accidental way during that research there. But my question then is, there are issues with research that are sticky. And this has been one that's been rather sticky over the years, stem cell research. Let me throw that out to you guys. Who wants to talk about that as it pertains to research?
It is a tough one, and opinions obviously will, that becomes an emotional issue as well as a scientific issue. In my own personal view, it's an extremely powerful tool that if well controlled, and it can be used to tremendous advantage without sort of encroaching on that emotional question.
Well, you see where I'm going with that question, because it goes back to the one I asked earlier about whether or not politics fit into the world of research. And from what I've seen over and heard in the news reports over the years as it pertains to stem cell research is that there is a political wing to this that is rather strident when it comes to not doing it. And I don't know, you know, I'm not trying to put anybody on the spot there, but I understand what you're saying, Dr. Smelser, that it is an important tool if used in the right way. Are there other areas of stem cell research that you guys are finding in other areas of the medical research that is equally important?
I'd like to switch just a little bit, kind of go back to your political question. So this very moment, there are actually hearings in Congress, House of Representatives, on research being supported by the National Science Foundation. It's the whole issue of, should Congress be looking at the type of science that a federal agency supports and making decisions about whether or not it should be done or not? To me, that's a huge problem, to have Congress kind of looking over the shoulders of federal agencies making determinations about whether science is worth doing or not.
Well, Dr. Cornett, was that an issue in years gone by?
It has been. I was actually thinking about that. There was, I can't remember the senator's name from one of the southern states, but he used to give out what he called the Golden Fleece Award for projects that were supported by the National Institutes of Health that he thought were frivolous or not worthy of being done. Mm-hmm. So this has been around for a while. It's nothing new.
Well, I think that probably is the prime example of politics getting involved and potentially in the way of science.
Staying with that younger perspective of things, Dr. Smelser, as you see young people coming into the field, are they going to stand for politics getting in the way of research? How do you handle your research when you see the obvious thing that's being brought to you when it conflicts with other social areas?
Well, I think everybody has to make certain decisions for themselves. I mean, stem cell research, for instance, isn't an issue at all for me, just because of what I do. I just think about patients. I lost my father to Alzheimer's disease. That I wouldn't wish that on anyone. If stem cell research has, and I believe that it does, although others could speak to that question better than I do, than I can, potential in that regard, then I think it would be unfortunate to not do what's necessary to realize that potential.
Are there some things that are just right on the cusp of being discovered or announced or worked on that in the areas of research that are exciting that you guys see in the future? Is there anything that's really on the horizon?
I personally think a pretty significant effort locally to exploit nanotechnology. It's in what by most standards would be considered its infancy, but again, I think it has tremendous potential. I do think there are some things, personalized medicine. So you go back to the issue of being able to generate massive amounts of data at the level of an individual and then utilize that data to tailor cancer therapy for that individual, so that now you're not just throwing stones, you know, you have targeted therapy. I think these are going to be things that potentially revolutionize many areas of medicine.
As you're mentioning that, my mind is seeing Star Trek, where the guy, I forget the doctor's name on Star Trek, where he puts this wand over the person and it tells him exactly what to do, blah, blah, blah. That's sort of what you're talking about, isn't it?
I think that there's tremendous potential there, and again, Dr. Cornett could speak to it better than I can, but it's my understanding that it's currently being utilized to great advantage on our campus, particularly at myeloma.
Yeah, so I think the whole notion of personalized medicine is an area that has tremendous potential. It's here now. It won't be very long before it costs less than $1,000 to have your genome sequenced. So in the not too distant future, all of us will have our genome sequenced, and then when we become ill and our physicians will be able to make use of that information and tailor their treatment to our specific disease.
But as of right now, physicians are not being trained in any way in this. Am I right? Is it so new that they wouldn't know the data if they had it in front of them to really use it?
I wouldn't go that far. I think our trainees, our medical students, our graduate students are being trained in these areas.
Oh, really? Right now?
Absolutely.
Mm. Part of that is goes into the area of clinical research, and that is our ability to have a wide enough net to capture patients from diverse ethnic backgrounds to be able to use this information, because we know, for example, that women metabolize, we've learned actually the hard way that women metabolize certain drugs a different ways, and we need to know that information in order to interpret what we get from the genomic makeup of the individual. Just because you have a gene for X doesn't mean that you're going to develop that problem. There are probably other aspects involved in that. And so I think that's very important. And mm-hmm. that goes down to the need to do research in different populations, children included, the elderly. The geriatric patient is a very different patient. And clinical research has to be targeted to that group. Pediatrics the same way. It's not the same as an adult. And so drugs, research has to be targeted to children.
In my career as a scientist, I've always found when I've done an experiment, it actually brings up about 5 to 10 more questions that mm-hmm. that need to be answered, and so I don't think it ever ends.
To go back to your point, the only thing I would add, and it's a personal addition, because my research does focus on infectious disease and specifically bacterial infections, is we have relied for over 50 years on antibiotics, and we're running out of them. There is some that has made its way to the popular press to some degree, but I think it's a perfect example of the issue of, is research ever done? We may find a new antibiotic tomorrow, but I guarantee you that this is a case where if you use it, you will lose it. And that's just the nature of infectious disease. So if you were to do that and suddenly have an antibiotic that was effective against everything, which, by the way, is an impossibility. Even if you could theoretically do it, that antibiotic has a defined life span. And if you were to, at that point, stop research into antibiotic development, which unfortunately almost all major drug companies have done, that would be a dire mistake. So I think that speaks quite well to the question of, is research ever done? And that's a decided no. And maybe I should be more precise. I'm a bacteriologist and use the term antibacterials. But when most people in the public think of antibiotic, they're thinking of antibacterials. And they are not effective against any virus.
But the issue is the same. So, for example, we have drugs that can treat herpes virus, herpes type 1 and 2, but we know that those viruses can become resistant to it. So again, the judicious use of the antibiotic or the antiviral, and if I said antibiotic, it should be antiviral, that's important for anything that you're going to treat, whether it's bacteria, viruses, fungi. It's a problem that will always occur. You'll develop resistance in the agent you're treating. If I could throw something else out there, I think the idea of research has to be in the general public. It has to be a public idea that everybody has to or should contribute to research. I mean, I do. I've been a subject in research studies. I've donated my blood for clinical trials. The only way, at least from a clinical trial point of view, that we can advance treatments, preventatives, diagnostic tests is if people participate. And I think that for parents, it's difficult for them to have their children participate in trials. But it's important for them to understand that we're not using them as, quote, guinea pigs. And people will say that, and I'm the first to say they're not being used as guinea pigs. We have studied these drugs in adults. We know that they're safe in that population. We want to carry that information down to another age group. And so we want to conduct investigations to see what the dose is and how we can use them in children. And that has to be part of our global commitment as a society. We have to all participate in research at some level mm-hmm. in order to make this work.
Dr. Romero brings up a great point, and I think this is something that's changed in clinical research from the time I started to the current day, and that is that we want to engage the community in all aspects of the research. And Dr. Romero talks about it's important for all of us to be research subjects, but it's also very important for the researchers to engage the community in the design of the research question. And that's something that we did not do very well 20 and 30 years ago. We would, you know, there are cases where researchers would descend upon a population that might have a very high incidence of diabetes, for example, draw blood samples, disappear, publish their paper, and never get back with the community and, show them what they found and show them how their research might help that population. So we have fortunately matured a great deal, and now we engage the community in designing the research question. We ask them, is this something you're interested in? And then we go from there.
As a clinical researcher, it's very important to have individuals from ethnic minorities, racial minorities in our society engage in research. And it's so important that the NIH has mandated that. If you have a population then you of individuals, that has to be encouraged. You have to bring them in. So it's very important. So the FDA has pretty much mandated the study of antibiotics in children. 20 years ago, a company would come out with an antibiotic and have it tested in adults and not worry about kids. And so if parents look at children, 90% of the drugs that we have today have never been tested in children. We don't know. We think we know what the right dose is, but it's never been tested. And that has changed in the last 15 years where the FDA said, no, we'll give you a license for this particular drug, but you must conduct trials in children to make sure that the dose is correct. And that's the type of research that we need to get parents involved in. The development of new antibiotics. We currently have 3 new antibiotics we're trying to determine the correct dosage for in children at UAMS and Arkansas Children's. We need parents to sort of listen to us and to allow us to begin to do that research in children.
So what do parents need to do? Do they need to call the university there? Or?
There are certain drugs that we ask or tests that we ask for volunteers, but a lot of times when the children are in the hospital and they're getting an antibiotic, you know, we'll say, well, look, your son or daughter is getting a similar antibiotic. We'd like to administer a single dose of this and measure how this drug is eliminated from mm-hmm. your child's body. And that's the beginning. Those are pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic studies that set the groundwork for clinical trials later on.
Right. And there is a website called clinicaltrials.gov that all clinical trials that are being conducted in this country are listed there. So if there's a parent that wants to look for clinical trials for their children to enroll in, that's the site to
go
to.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Dr. Cornett.
There are many things we do at both UAMS and ACHRI to inform the public of our research programs. Our website is full of information. We have the Translational Research Institute, which is funded by the NIH, and they have a very active effort to inform the public of research that is going on at our campuses, as well as opportunities to participate in research.
I think it's worth noting, though, that what you're doing here is an invaluable service. Dr. Cornett brought it up before. I've personally never spoken with anyone who expressed who would say that they do not support biomedical research. But at the same time, for the public, most have a sense of it, but don't understand the basis, the mechanics of it. And frankly, that's why I'm here, because I think it's fundamentally important that people like me take the time to do what they can to help with that understanding. Without a forum like this, I just be sitting in my office complaining about the same things.
Well, this is a perfect time for me to do a plug for NPR, and because this is our program airs during the fund drive. So if you agree with Dr. Smelcher that having programs like this on public radio where we don't have to worry about commercials butting into us for a half an hour a program, then you do need to call the station and support us here at KUAR. I do want to thank my guests for being with me here today. We've had a great discussion about research, and the longer version of our program will be on our website at KUAR.org and our program website, which is yttshow.org. So you can pick up that longer version right there. My guest from the older generation has been Dr. Larry Cornett. He's a professor in the Department of Physiology and Biophysics and the Vice Chancellor for Research at UAMS. Dr. Cornett, so glad you could be with me here today.
It's been my pleasure.
And then speaking from the middle generation perspective has been Dr. Jose Romero. He participates in clinical research related to viral and antiviral therapies through the NIH and NAID supported collaborative antiviral study group. Dr. Romero, again, thanks for you being here too.
Thank you for the invitation.
And also from that younger generation, and I appreciate the comments about our program, Dr. Smelcher, has been Dr. Mark Speltzer. His research interests here at UMS include molecular pathogenesis of Staphylococcus. I'm glad you could be with us here today, too, Dr. Smelcher.
It has been my pleasure, and I will be forever grateful that you used the word younger generation.
Yes. Well, it's kind of relative, if you know what I mean.
It is relative, yes.
Again, folks, I hope you've enjoyed our program. If you'd like to listen to that longer version, you can catch it at our websites there. Be sure and join us next week. We're going to lighten up the load a little bit. Our program next week will be on witches. We'll be on during the Halloween time, so I thought I'd really lighten it up. We go from research to witches. How about that? Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.